Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. A man who begged to be cured, only to be turned away or deemed untreatable. Tortured and humiliated by his mother, he sought out any barfly that reminded him of her. Okay, on to the show. Carol Edward Cole was born on May 9, 1938, in Sioux City, Iowa, to Laverne and Vesta Cole. When his younger sister was born in 1939, the family decided to move to Richmond, California. In 1940, Laverne had his number called and was drafted to fight in World War II. Vesta took this opportunity to carry on affairs with other men. She often carried out these drunken affairs in front of young Carol, allowing him to watch her engage and entertain the male callers that came to their apartment. In order to ensure that 5-year-old Carol never told his father what he witnessed, she would beat and threaten him into silence. This pattern of meeting a room full of drunken men while Carol waited in a nearby room continued for years. It's hard to determine why Vesta hated her son so much, but she seemed to gain some sort of pleasure in hurting and humiliating him. She would dress him up in girls' clothing and prance him around. She belittled him for being weak and even made fun of his first name. Carol recalls that this is the moment he hated his mother. She was a drunk, loose, unfaithful woman, and he was utterly disgusted by her. I reached out to my friend Brooke. She's a licensed counselor and co-host of the Fall Line podcast, to ask her about the early childhood experiences Carol had and how those experiences contributed to his desire to kill women. She said if he felt that his mother humiliated him and he was never able to get even, if you will, then it makes total sense that he would kill women to get revenge on his mom, especially if he generalized that all women were the same and that they were all out to humiliate him. He would need to exert his power over them to make sure he was never humiliated again. His father returned home in 1945, and although the beatings were less brutal, they still continued. His mother reasoned that she couldn't send her now first grader to school with bruises. When Carol entered the first grade at age 7, a year after he was legally required to be enrolled, he was hit with a new enemy, schoolyard bullies. They teased him for his feminine name, so he insisted that everyone call him Eddie. He was often brought to tears when ganged up on and said that he felt, quote, the animosity, withdrawing more and more into myself. One evening after school, Carol was hiding underneath the porch at his home. He recalls blacking out and then waking up to find that the family's pet dog was lying dead next to him. He felt an overwhelming sense of relief wash over him, even though he did not recall the act. After strangling the dog, his fantasies of murdering his mother began to emerge, and he would imagine the many different ways he could snuff out his mother's life. He didn't act on his urges, despite the overwhelming desire to. During the summer of 1946, Carol decided to join his older brother and a group of boys to go swim at a harbor. One of the young boys on the excursion was named Duane. Duane was one of the many classmates who taunted him over his name. While walking towards the harbor, Duane called out, "How does it feel to have a girl's name, Carol?" Carol felt an immediate pang of embarrassment and rage rise up inside of him, and he knew what he was going to do. When the boys reached the harbor, they swam and played as if nothing was amiss. When Duane and Carol were alone, he saw this as an opportunity to strike. Duane planned to jump into the harbor and found a log to jump from. Carol watched, calculating his next move. When Duane jumped into the harbor, he swam underwater for a bit. As he was going to make his way back up to the surface, he felt a pair of legs wrap around his neck. He struggled, confused, and tried to free himself, but they were clamped so tightly. Carol had grabbed onto a log to use it for leverage. He wasn't going to let go until his tormentor died. When he felt Duane give up the struggle and go limp, he released him. Dwayne's body floated to the bottom of the harbor, and when the boys returned to the pair, they realized that Dwayne had drowned. At least that's what Carol told them. The authorities ruled his death an accident, but that didn't stop Carol from feeling paranoid. He was afraid that the cops were going to arrest him, but he didn't really care that he had just murdered his classmate. He was satisfied with himself because he had finally stood up to a bully, something he wasn't able to do with his biggest tormentor, his mother. Most serial killers continue to murder because the urge to kill is only staved off for a short time. And that's exactly what happened with Cole. He thought by killing Dwayne that the bullying would stop. But the problem is, no one knew he killed Dwayne, so he was still the same old Carol to them. The one that could be bullied into tears, the one who got angrier and more aggressive. Thoughts of murdering anyone who crossed him, teased him, or hurt him always seemed to cross his mind. He managed to mask his feelings and intrusive thoughts until he entered high school. He was a D-average student who was the ultimate underachiever. He tested at a genius level, so school officials determined Cole's bad grades were simply occurring out of laziness. He dropped out of high school during his junior year and began committing petty crimes. He also began abusing alcohol more frequently. In 1957, at the age of 19, he enlisted in the Navy. A year later, he would be dishonorably discharged after being arrested for burglary. He stole pistols and used them to fire at cars along the highway. He was also charged with auto theft. And it's interesting to note that after he was discharged from the Navy, and with the opportunity to go anywhere in the world, anywhere he wanted, he returned to his family's home in Richmond, California. He was taunted relentlessly by his mother, who called him a failure for being discharged. He could have fought back and harmed his mother, but he didn't. Instead, he decided to harm complete strangers. The urge to kill overtook him once again, and on June 1, 1960, with a hammer in his hand, he strolled down the local Lover's Lane. He saw a car parked and snuck up to the window. He attacked the couple with a hammer and then ran away. He found another car and committed the same act with a new couple. He was apprehended and charged with assault with a deadly weapon. On June 28, 1960, he was sentenced to 30 days of labor on a work farm. He turned 22 years old in 1961, and that was the first time he asked for help. He flagged down a Richmond police car for assistance. When he approached the officers, Carol confessed that he had strong urges to rape and strangle women. There isn't confirmation that he informed them of the two prior assaults that he had just committed the year earlier, but the officers told him that he should commit himself voluntarily to the psychiatric hospital. In February of 1961, he voluntarily committed himself to the Napa State Hospital for observation. His observation would last 90 days, and he refused to discuss his mother's cruelty towards him or Dwayne's murder. Instead, he suggested that his childhood was happy and idyllic. When his mother Vesta was called in to discuss Carol's youth, she confirmed her son's story, that his childhood was essentially perfect. He was seen as a sexual psychopath who might be dangerous to the community and ultimately was diagnosed as having antisocial sociopathic personality disorder. Psychology Today describes individuals with this particular disorder. They may seem charming on the surface, but they are likely to be irritable and aggressive, as well as irresponsible. They may have numerous somatic complaints and perhaps attempt suicide. Due to their manipulative tendencies, it is difficult to tell whether they are lying or telling the truth. Some of the symptoms of the disorder include disregard for society's laws, violation of the physical or emotional rights of others, lack of stability in job and home life, irritability and aggressiveness, and a lack of remorse. It's almost a playbook for Carol's later crimes. He was released from treatment on March 25, 1961. Since they described him as not treatable and recommended he seek outpatient treatment, which he did not. He continued to commit crimes that landed him in the county or state jail. While serving a sentence for auto theft, he requested psychiatric assistance for his mental condition. The judge agreed to sentence him to treatment at the Ascadero State Hospital. He left psychiatrists puzzled at his test results because they often varied in diagnosis. They found him to be deceitful in his answers, and thus in October of 1961, he was transferred to Stockton State Hospital for further treatment and evaluation. In Stockton, he seemed to be more open about his urges to kill women and where those feelings stemmed from. His psychiatrist noted that he was intimidated or afraid of females and needed to kill them before having sex with them. At Stockton, he was diagnosed as having schizophrenic reaction, which created an indefinite absence of the self. He was released in April of 1963. It seemed as if no one could or would help him with the mental illness he was suffering from. Keep in mind that Mindhunter, the book and later show about the FBI in its infancy of profiling serial killers, takes place in 1977, 16 years after Carol's stint in the psych ward, and a year after Carol's release from Stockton, Edmund Kemper committed his first murder. The psychiatric field was not prepared for this level of sociopathy and had no idea how to treat Carol. His mother, Vesta, determined that Carol needed a change of scenery and bought him a bus ticket to Dallas, Texas. His older brother, Richard, moved to Dallas with his wife and welcomed Carol's visit. When Carol arrived, his brother showed him around the city and took him to various bars in the area. After a few weeks, Carol ventured into the city on his own. He visited a local dive bar in July of 1963, and as he exited, he saw two women waiting for their bus. The liquid courage strong in him, he decided to kill one. He boarded the bus with them and exited when they did. They separated and he followed one of them. He removed his belt and wrapped it around his fist, getting ready to attack her. He crossed the street and began walking faster to get closer to her. She heard him and turned around to confront him. She remembered him from the bus and just turned to walk away again. He saw this as a final opportunity to strike and wrap the belt around her throat. She's wrenched back and he pulled hard, but the belt is not flexible and does not have the effect he's hoping for. She turned to face him while screaming and kicking and scratching at him. They fell to the sidewalk and the struggle continued. This particular area in Dallas had some apartments that overlooked the busy sidewalk. A man came out and yelled at them to stop making so much noise or he would call the cops. Carol released the belt from around the woman's throat and ran away from the scene. She screamed for the man to call the police, and he did. Carol circled back, lingering in the darkness to see if he could strike again. He saw officers arrive and the woman told them that her attacker took off running. They took her report and left without searching. They didn't see Carol lurking in the darkness across the street. He returned to Richard's home and read the Dallas Morning News to see if the assault made the paper. It did, and he learned the woman's name and occupation. Priscilla Hose was a ticketing agent at the Dallas Love Field Airport. He wanted to go back now that he knew where she lived, but ultimately the feeling of failure gave him the urge to return to the dive bar from the night before instead. He spent some time drinking at the bar, and that's when he spotted her. It couldn't be. Priscilla was there, and they locked eyes. His stomach sank, and he sat at the bar continuing to drink, waiting for authorities to arrive. They never do. She never called the cops. Perhaps it was to let him know that she knew who he was, and that he better leave her alone. It worked. He was embarrassed and his face flushed red. He drank that night and several nights after, wallowing in his failures and trying to settle his unnatural urges. He returned to his brother's home and downed a bottle of pills in an attempt to commit suicide. He left the home so Richard wouldn't find him and instead drank until he passed out on the street. He was found by patrolmen who took him to Parkland Hospital, the same hospital that in 4 months would treat the wounded President of the United States, John F. Kennedy. Carol's stomach was pumped and he told the doctors he attempted to end his life because he was experiencing money troubles. He was committed to the psychiatric ward of the hospital for 4 days. During this stint, he was diagnosed with an emotionally unstable personality disorder. During his treatment, he did not show any progress and was released. Psychiatrists recommended he enter the state adult mental health clinic. Carroll said he would follow up, but that was another lie. When he was released, he looked for quick work. He never held a stable job and either quit or was fired. He seemed to be doing better, though his drinking continued. His brother and sister-in-law wanted to take Carroll out to forget about his troubles. When they visited a bar, the three ran into a woman Richard's wife knew. She was a young, fit, and attractive blonde who had her share of troubles. She kept commenting on Carroll's youthful looks and didn't believe that he was 25 years old. They chatted throughout the night, and when Carroll returned home, the phone rang. It was the woman. She asked if he wanted to come over and spend the evening with her. He agreed, and when he arrived, they drank, had sex, and slept. Carroll didn't return to Richard's home after that night. He moved some of his personal items into her motel room. Soon after moving in, she told a friend that she planned to leave town with his paycheck. That information was shared with Carroll at some point, and he opted to check into a different motel room, leaving her without the funds to run out on him. When he returned back to his motel room, he saw a young woman and a male suitor enter a room across from his. He could hear their encounter throughout the night and fell asleep to the sounds. The next morning, he saw the woman from the night before sitting in the doorway of her motel room. He stopped by and introduced himself as Eddie Cole. She shook his hand and said her name was Billy Whitworth. She was from Melissa, Texas, which is about 50 miles north of Dallas. In 1963, Melissa was a country town, dirt roads and full of small farms. It's not the up-and-coming city that it is today. She was a redhead with a sad face. That's what he remembered about her. She told him she was a dancer at a strip club and was also an escort. She shared that she had a young daughter that lived with her at the motel, that she was diabetic and an alcoholic. He was initially turned off by the fact that she was a sex worker. It reminded him of his mother, but still, Carroll was attracted to her chaos. He left her and went to work, returning back to her room that evening. The next day, the same thing happened. This time, he found Billy half-drunk watching TV. He heard a small cry and opened the closet to find 3-year-old Lucinda Whitworth crying in a pool of her own urine. He was enraged that she would do this to her daughter and beat Billy. He had a flashback to his own childhood and took out his pain and aggression on Billy. Carroll and Billy fought constantly and roamed from motel to motel. Lucinda would be taken from her mother on several occasions and eventually placed with relatives. She was free from the constant alcohol-fueled fights. Carroll was not happy essentially being Billy's pimp, but still took on the role. He quit his job, filed for disability, and drank all day. Billy sold her body to support their diet of bologna sandwiches and alcohol. Billy worked for Jack Ruby, who was a notorious Dallas nightclub owner. Jack often dealt with shady characters and acted as a pimp for the dancers in his club. Carroll hated him with a passion. Jack would approach Billy and nuzzle her neck and grab her butt while Carroll was sitting right next to them. When Carroll protested this behavior, Jack backed off. One night, Billy showed Carroll a Polaroid of herself naked, legs spread eagle, on Jack's desk. Carroll beat her, but it's as if Billy wanted it. He knew that she did things or said things to entice him into a fight. It was as if Billy wanted the bruises and scars she held inside to show on her skin. Or maybe the beatings were assigned to her that Carroll cared. Jack knew that Carroll was seeking revenge, so whenever he arrived to his club, Jack would make his exit. Jack wouldn't be a problem for Carroll very much longer.
He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. There's the man with a gun. It's absolute panic. Absolute panic here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Detectives have their guns drawn. Oswald has been shot. There is no question about it, Oswald.
In November of 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald was charged with murdering the then U.S. President, John F. Kennedy. As Lee was being transported to jail, Jack brandished a gun and shot him dead. He was arrested and charged with murder. He was found guilty as the murder occurred on live television. He was out of the picture and no longer a source of grief for Carol. That same month, Carol and Billy got married. They moved from the hotel to a house in East Dallas. Carol found another job, and the turmoil seemed to calm between the couple. They even attended church and visited Billy's parents to announce their marriage. However, something changed when they returned home. The honeymoon phase was immediately over. They returned to drinking heavily and fighting. He was fired from his job due to his late-night spats and brawls with Billy. In order to relieve himself of his frustrations, he strangled the kittens their cat gave birth to. Billy had no way of knowing that her husband had these homicidal urges. When he ran out of kittens, he began to choke Billy during sex. She was often seen with bruises around her neck, but no one seemed to care as they thought it came with the territory of being a sex worker. It could have been any of her Johns. He met a 19-year-old neighbor who claimed to be a nymphomaniac. They engaged in a sexual affair for some time, with Billy interrupting to start a fight with him. He wanted to kill the young woman, but the risk of getting caught was too high. Carol's life was a wasteland of alcohol, fighting, sex, and murderous urges. The urges boiled over one summer night in 1964, when he returned home to find Billy having sex with another man in their bed. He spotted Lucinda sitting on the couch, and he had immediate flashbacks to his childhood. He stumbled to the kitchen and grabbed a sharp meat fork. He closed in on the man, who managed to leave the house upon seeing the fork and the look in Carol's eyes. Billy charged toward Carol, and he took a swipe at her, and he slashed her stomach. She screamed and ran out of the house naked. He dropped the fork and began to assault Lucinda. Police quickly spotted Billy, and she informed them that her husband was alone with her daughter in their home. They arrived and stopped the assault on Lucinda, arresting him for assault. Billy begged her parents for the bail money and refused to press charges against her husband. They decided to take Lucinda back to her grandparents and Melissa. While there, her parents tried to convince him to divorce him. Frustrated with the conversation, he took his father-in-law's truck out for a drive with Billy's sister, Jean. When they returned to the home, Billy knew exactly what had transpired between them and gave Carol the silent treatment for 50 miles during the ride home. On January 5, 1965, he was arrested for public drunkenness and thrown in the drunk tank. Carol couldn't keep quiet. He said he wanted to talk about a crime he committed several years prior. They heard him out, and he confessed to attacking Priscilla Hose. He was charged with assault. When Priscilla was called to do a visual lineup, she immediately pointed out Carol. She would never forget that baby face. He pled guilty and served a little over 2 months in county jail. He was released that following March. They eventually lost their home and returned to living in motels. They picked the Carlton Hotel and continued the same pattern of drinking, having sex, selling Billy, and fighting. One night, Carol was convinced that Billy was turning tricks with the men in the hotel. On August 10, 1965, after a night of drinking with his brother and the rage fueling inside of him, he decided to do something about Billy's infidelities. He parked behind the hotel and pulled out a can of gas he'd just purchased. He began to empty the can along the border of the hotel. When the can was empty, he lit a match and dropped it. He ran back to his car with the glow of the fire lighting his way. He made his way to a payphone, absolutely giddy with excitement. Billy finally got what she deserved. He didn't care if anyone else was affected by the fire. He called the police operator line and asked how they liked the fire. The operator hesitated, but her instincts told her to stall the caller. She said that it was pretty great. Delighted by her answer, he asked if she would like to go out with him. She agreed and said her shift was coming to an end shortly, so why not meet tonight? They set up a meeting place, and when Carol arrived, police were waiting to arrest him. He was indicted for arson on August 19, 1965. Billy was not harmed in the fire, but her marriage to Carol was temporarily over. Carol was sentenced to 2 years in prison, but would only serve 9 months. He was found with magazine clippings of men strangling women, which led to another evaluation by psychiatrists at Parkland Hospital. He was again diagnosed as a schizophrenic, but found to be mentally fit and returned to jail. He was released in January of 1966 and bought a one-way ticket to Oklahoma. He drifted around the city, drinking and buying women. He hated the neighborhood he was in because it was full of those he found to be the most undesirable. He met a young woman named Lisa and began a relationship with her. She liked that he was a bad boy, but maybe she would have thought different had she known about his fantasies of murdering women and wanting to have sex with their corpses. A few months into his stay, he got word from a pimp that Billy was on the streets looking for him. He couldn't get away from this woman, and he wasn't sure if he wanted to. Lisa left him after he brought Billy to their home. Their cycle of destruction continued. He would be arrested in April of 1967 and charged with vagrancy by pimping, essentially living off of the money Billy made selling her body. After one too many rows with his wife, he stopped by a bar for one last drink. He saw Billy walk in, looking around for him, and snuck out through the back door. He made his way to the Greyhound bus station and bought another one-way ticket, this time to Tulsa, Oklahoma. He found a few odd jobs here and there that were used to pay for his alcohol habit. He ran into women to engage in sex with, but eventually had his fill of Tulsa. He briefly stopped in St. Louis, Missouri, but found it to be too depressing and not up to his standards. It was too dirty. He decided to hitchhike on May 27, 1967, and was picked up by a group of partygoers headed to Lake Ozark. He got in the car and was immediately offered booze and pills. He was surprised by his luck and took them willingly. They arrived to Lake Ozark, and he spent 3 drug and alcohol-fueled days there. As his time and money was running out, he opted for one last drink in the local tap house before returning to the working life. The bar closed at 2 a.m., and he needed to find a place to sleep. He wandered around the small town looking for a storeroom to break into and sleep in until the morning. He passed by the local cafe and saw a staircase leading up to a small, what he believed to be a storeroom. He opened the door with ease because it was unlocked. His eyes took time to adjust before he realized that he was in an apartment. He saw a figure in a bed and believed it to be a woman. He got on his hands and knees and began to crawl under her bed. He just needed to sleep, but then he got an idea. He could finally take this opportunity to kill. He hadn't been seen by anyone as it was early in the morning. He could get away with it. He lurched over her and wrapped his hands around her throat and squeezed. The young girl immediately woke up and tried to scream. She struggled and gasped but could not escape the powerful grip on her throat. His hands and arms began to cramp since he's struggling so hard, and he relaxed his grip to stretch his fingers. She screamed loudly, waking everyone up in the home. He ran out of the apartment and down the stairs. People heard the screams and chased after him. He tried to hide in an alleyway but was immediately found by a crowd. They walked him to the local jail. When the 11-year-old girl came out from the apartment, her neck red and nose bleeding, she identified Carol as her attacker. He immediately professed his guilt. He had no idea that she was a child, and this is what caused him to confess to the crime. He was arraigned on charges of felonious assault with the intent to ravage and entered a plea of not guilty by reason of mental defect. He was offered a plea deal of a lesser charge, assault with intent to kill, and without being labeled a sex offender. If he accepted the deal, he would only serve 5 years as opposed to 10 years. Carol willingly accepted the deal. He knew if he served his time with good behavior, he would be out of prison in 2 to 3 years. While in prison, he got word that Billy passed away due to complications from her diabetes, pneumonia, and rot gut. He was depressed for some time after her death, and despite participating in a prison riot, he was released on May 1, 1970, having made no significant changes or improvement. Of his release and supposed rehabilitation, he said, "If anything, I was worse."
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor.
His plan before the Lake Ozark incident was to return to California. However, he was instead sent to South Carolina to attend a vocational school to learn how to operate heavy equipment. It was a way to ensure he had a skill to use that would assist him in finding a job. The course lasted 3 weeks. He wanted to make a stop in El Paso, Texas, a town that shares a border with Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. He wanted to cross the border for the cheap sex workers. He had no trouble finding them, as they usually latched onto foreigners in the hopes of bigger paydays. Possibly due to his drinking or the fact that the sex workers were alive, Carroll found that he was unable to perform for the women he paid for. Dejected and humiliated, he returned to El Paso to drink himself blind. He was running out of money, and he knew he would have to find quick work if he planned on drinking the next few nights. As fate would have it, one evening he sat next to a man who was a recovering alcoholic. He offered Carroll a plane ticket to go to his friend's detox center. Having no other options and running dangerously low on cash, he agreed to fly with the man to San Diego. Upon arrival, they drove to Chula Vista, California, where he was given food, shelter, and new clothing. But the man, known only as Roger, had left without saying goodbye. For a short time, he attended Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and worked with a painting contractor. However, he didn't like having to work for his money. Because he spent time in prison, his disability benefits were stopped and he applied for welfare. He was given $120 a month to live off of, and he tried his damnedest to drink it all away. He was arrested on July 21, 1970, for public drunkenness. He jumped bail and went back to Stockton, California to check himself into the state hospital. They told him that they would not admit him unless authorities in San Diego recommended him for care. He hated the rejection and hitchhiked to Reno, Nevada. Alcohol, once used to dull his urges, was no longer working as effectively as it had in the past. He still wanted so badly to strangle and murder women. He tried to strangle 2 women in Nevada. Both attempts were failures. The women escaped with their lives, and Carroll's urges were more alive than ever. Every attempt he had made thus far only resulted in failure. His mother was right about him, and he hated it. On September 19, 1970, he walked into the Reno, Nevada police station and told the desk sergeant that he dreamed of murdering women, that every woman he encountered, he wanted to strangle and defile her corpse. The desk sergeant booked him on disorderly conduct and shared with his supervisors what Carroll said. They filed an application for evaluation and examination with the Reno District Court. A psychiatrist deemed him to have a sociopathic personality disorder and supported the decision to have him evaluated in a state hospital. The judge accepted the application and he was admitted to the state hospital in Sparks, Nevada. His attending psychiatrist was Dr. Felix Peebles, who surmised that Carroll had antisocial personality disorder that caused him to want to murder and defile attractive females. A social worker assigned to Carroll believed that Carroll was just making up his claims and using his petty arrests as a way to get shelter and food when his funds ran out. He also stated that Carroll would not be a danger to the community since he self-reported prior to causing any harm. Dr. Peebles reviewed the observation and agreed. After 10 days in state care, he was released and told that if he felt he needed psychiatric intervention, to seek it in San Diego. This would be the last time that Carroll Cole would seek any intervention. Of his last stint, he would share, "My urges were stronger than ever, but I wasn't concerned about it anymore. I just said to hell with it and waited to see what would happen. It would be to the detriment of the women he encountered, starting with 39-year-old Essie Louise Buck. He met Essie on May 7, 1971. They talked and drank. In fact, she owned the tavern where they met. Heavily drunk, she agreed to join Carol in his car. They kissed for a while until Carol couldn't hold back his true intentions. He reached over and strangled her with his bare hands. She slapped at his forearms, her eyes wide with confusion. He learned from his past mistakes and, despite the cramping in his hands and arms, pushed down harder on her throat. He watched the life slip from her eyes. He got out of the car and put her in the trunk. He returned to the motel room to sleep off the high. On his 33rd birthday, May 9, 1971, he dumped her body in a Poway, California field where she was found sometime later by a child. She was unidentified for some time, and the coroner could not pinpoint a cause of death. He was only able to determine that she had a high blood alcohol content. Carol thought he would have felt overjoyed at being successful in murdering Essie, but he felt nothing. He thought perhaps it was because he didn't act out his full fantasy, which included having sex with her dead body. He raped her while she was still alive. Whatever the reason, he wasn't satisfied at all by her death. Carol would state later in a prison confession that he murdered two women by strangulation just 2 weeks after murdering Essie Buck. However, the accounts have never been verified, and the remains of Wilma and a second unidentified woman, whose name Carol could not recall, have never been found. In June of 1971, he was serving time for theft and driving while intoxicated. He was questioned by Detective Robert Ring. Detective Ring was assigned to the homicide investigation of Essie Buck. Several witnesses came forward and claimed that the last time she was seen alive was with Carol Cole as they left the bar together. Carol's blood drained from his face, and he told Detective Ring that he was with Essie that evening, but when he woke up the next morning, she was dead. In a panic, he discarded her body because he was afraid he would be accused of her murder. Ring didn't look further into it and believed that because of her high alcohol levels, that Cole's story was likely true. After being released from jail in March of 1972, he headed to San Ysidro to find more women to kill. At this point, he was still chasing an unobtainable gratification from the murders he committed. He met two unknown Hispanic women in a bar. He offered to take them to another bar where they could continue drinking. They accepted his offer and got into his car. When he pulled over to allow one of the women to relieve herself, he took the opportunity to strike the other woman with a hammer. He waited for the first woman to return, and before she could react, he strangled her to death. He placed both bodies in the trunk of his car and drove to the desert to bury them. Their bodies would never be recovered. It was now the summer of 1972, and it seemed as if Carol's life was in a constant state of repetition. He had spent more time in jail on another drunk driving charge. After his release, he immediately went back to drinking. As was his custom, Carol would move from bar to bar, drinking away every dollar he had. One day, he stumbled half-drunk into a bar where he met Diana Paschal. She was a barmaid at the time, and the two struck up a conversation. They soon began a relationship where monogamy was not their strong suit. She reminded him of his mother, which he hated. Despite the warning signs, in July of 1973, Carol proposed to Diana. Diana said yes, and it was like he was living with Billy all over again. Their fights, their sex, their infidelity, it was all the same. On the eve of their one-year anniversary, Carol decided to celebrate by going to Las Vegas with a new girlfriend. A month later, he came back home to Diana, who forgave him. The couple decided that San Diego was not a good place for them to live if their relationship was going to survive. They made a mutual decision to leave San Diego behind and move to Las Vegas, Nevada, in August of 1974. Their move would make little difference in their relationship. He managed to find a job pulling coins from the slot machines from the airport casino and transporting them back to the casinos in downtown Las Vegas. Baited with the temptation of fast and easy money, he took off with some money and abandoned Diana. He traveled east and landed in Casper, Wyoming, finding work on an oil rig. On August 4, 1975, he met Merlene T.B. Hamer, who was married at the time. Carol had noticed that she was half Native American. They struck up a conversation at the bar and got to drinking. Carol suggested that they take a ride so that they could have more privacy, and Merlene accepted his offer. Carol was already secretly angry with her for wearing a ring and showing her willingness to be unfaithful. As they drove along the dark stretches of road, Carol claimed she offered to have sex with him. He accepted, but had a different type of gratification in mind for himself. He pulled into the parking lot of a plant where he was working and turned off the car. He carried on a conversation with her and reached for an electrical cord. He pulled it up around her neck and used it as a garrote. She died and slumped on the seat. He released the cord and fell asleep himself, resting his head on her cold, dead shoulder. When he awoke later that morning, he drove with her body in the passenger seat towards some foothills north of Casper. He disrobed her and dumped her there. He grabbed a sleeping bag from his car and covered her body with it. On August 9, 1975, her body was discovered. He realized that he could be placed with her, so he abandoned the life in Wyoming and headed back to San Diego, where Diana had returned to after being abandoned in Las Vegas. He continued to drink heavily and in 1976 admitted himself into a detox center. Unable to stay out of trouble, he stole a check from a fellow patient and tried to cash it. The problem with this attempt was that the check was from the government and without proper identification could not be cashed. He was arrested and charged with mail fraud, but was released on bail in June of 1976. He again jumped his bail, but was later captured and a charge of unlawful flight was tacked on to the mail fraud charge. He was sentenced to 1 year in jail. He paroled in April of 1977 and returned to Las Vegas, Nevada. In May of 1977, he met sex worker Kathleen Blum in a Vegas bar. They hit it off, and despite the urge to kill her right away, he instead chose her company over the course of a few days. They met up at a bar called Dan and Ray's and drank for a few hours. The pair decided to leave and made their way to an alley. As they were kissing, Kathleen backed up against a wall. Carol raised his hands and wrapped them tightly around her neck. She was stunned by the sudden stop of air entering her lungs. She quickly fell limp and was unconscious, but alive. He removed her bra and choked her with that until she died. When he knew she was dead, he had sex with her body. When he was done, he dragged her body to a nearby yard and dumped her. The following day, on May 14, 1977, she was found. There were no leads in the case, and people couldn't recall the stranger she left with that night, so her case remained unsolved. Carol was arrested in North Las Vegas for stealing a vehicle. When he posted bail, he went on the lam and headed back towards Oklahoma City. He found his way into a topless bar on November 23, 1977. He met an unknown woman in the bar and agreed to go back with her to her apartment. He only remembered waking up the next morning, finding the sheets dirtied with human excrement and clothes strewn about. A trail of blood led to the bathtub where the woman's body was found partially dismembered. He stumbled back into the kitchen and found a piece of her buttock in the frying pan. He morbidly thought to himself, "I guess I did some cooking the night before." He knew he needed to dispose of her body, so he got the hacksaw that he used the night before and finished the job. He got dressed, gathered what was left of her, and tossed her parts into black garbage bags. He left her body in the city dump. If this is true, her body was never recovered. He returned to Texas in 1978, finding work in Denver City, Texas. It sits on the far west side of Texas, close to the New Mexican border. The city was considered a dry city, meaning no hard liquor was sold. But that didn't deter Carol. He would find a wet city, get alcohol, and take it back with him to Denver City. He was arrested for public intoxication, and it was discovered that he was wanted back in California. He was extradited and sentenced in March of 1978 to 6 months in jail and 3 years of probation that required him to gain full-time employment and attend an alcohol rehabilitation program. He was released in June of 1978 and reunited with Diana. There was still tension when he moved back in, and Diana made him sleep on the couch until he earned his place back into her bed. He violated his probation several times by being arrested for public intoxication and other various offenses that caused his probation to be extended. He didn't really care and had no plans to meet the requirements of his probation. He was focused on only one thing, finding another victim. He found her on August 27, 1979. Her name was Bonnie Sue O'Neill, and she was a sex worker with alcoholism. He walked with her to the back of his workplace, an appliance store, and had sex with her there. He remembers the sex being explosive, but it all ended when Bonnie proclaimed she needed to phone her husband. He lunged at her and strangled her until she died. He removed all of her clothing, threw her body in the alley, and tossed her clothing into the garbage behind the store. The authorities never questioned the owners of the appliance store or really investigated her death. The coroner's report came back noting that she died as a result of cirrhosis of the liver. They really didn't seem to care that the manner in which she was found indicated a homicide. It was just another dead sex worker to them. His marriage with Diana continued to deteriorate in the month following Bonnie's murder. He finally had enough of her and strangled her to death. He didn't care about the consequences. He wrapped her body in some blankets and stuffed it into a closet. He crawled under the crawl space of a neighbor's house, intending to dig a grave for Diana's body. The neighbor found him digging and quickly called the police. They picked him up and transferred him to a detox center. Diana's mother, worried about her daughter, went to their home and discovered her daughter's decomposing body in her bedroom closet. She called authorities, but Carroll had already made a run for it. This time, he was headed back to Las Vegas. Diana's autopsy revealed that she died from alcohol poisoning, and her death was ruled accidental. Carroll had no reason to run. He arrived in Las Vegas and began working as a truck driver. He didn't mind the work. It was mindless and allowed him to continue daydreaming about his wicked fantasies. He still didn't feel any gratification, and it seemed as if with every murder he was trying to feel some sort of satisfaction, but it would just never come to fruition. He began dating a female coworker and proposed to her shortly after, but he could not stop cheating on her. Their relationship ended as quickly as it began. He met Marie Cushman on November 3, 1979, at the Caspa Hotel, where they both drank pretty heavily. Marie's husband arrived sometime that evening and demanded she return home. Marie got the better of him and verbally berated and belittled him in front of onlookers. Embarrassed, her husband left the hotel. Carroll paid for a room and Marie joined him. As a thank you, she offered him oral sex, and when the act was finished, he got dressed. He claims Marie wanted more of him, but he denied her advances. She was continuing to ask for it until he could take no more. He grasped her throat firmly until he grabbed a piece of rope hanging from his pant pocket. He quickly wrapped it around her neck before she could scream and strangled her until her face fell into the bed and she stopped breathing. He finished getting dressed, leaving Marie's nude body and the rope in the room. The following day, her body was discovered by the housekeeping staff of the hotel. There were no solid or credible leads on her case, and it remained unsolved. He married his third wife, Charlotte Cole, on December 16, 1979, and they drove to Texas for their honeymoon. While in Texas, he was pulled over for driving without a valid license. Several warrants came back for him, and he was arrested. He was sent to the Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri. He was observed by a psychiatrist who wrote in a medical report that Carroll would not respond to intervention and would likely make no improvements in his conduct. Surprisingly, he was released on October 4, 1980, and was sent back to Dallas, Texas. He was back on the streets in no time, searching for more victims. On November 10, 1980, he met and strangled 52-year-old Dorothy King in her apartment. They met at a Dallas bar, and he agreed to accompany her back to her apartment. He strangled her almost immediately. When he was sure that she was dead, he cleaned up her body and had sex with it. He slept next to her that evening and woke up periodically throughout the night to have intercourse with her body again. He left the morning of the 11th, locking the door behind him, and went out drinking. He returned a few hours later and again had intercourse with her body. When he was sure he had his fill of her, he left her apartment for good. A friend would later request a welfare check since she had been absent from work for 2 days. The police found her body, and since there was no sign of forced entry, determined that this was likely an accidental death. The coroner confirmed that she likely died of alcohol poisoning. On November 11, 1980, he met 32-year-old Wanda Faye Roberts at a Dallas bar. She sat next to him and began talking to him. The group of men she was with got angry with her and threatened Carol. The room was tense with a possible fight, but the bartender intervened and the men she came with left without her. She told Carol she wanted to thank him personally for helping her out. They walked out of the bar toward a dark alleyway. She grabbed him and began kissing him, allowing his hands to wander all over her body. His hands are only interested in one part of her body, her neck. He quickly and tightly gripped it, still in a kiss. She pulled away, and he swiped her legs from underneath her, causing her to land on her knees. He never lost his firm grip on her throat. He got her on her back and straddled her chest, still fighting the cramps that were taking over his hands and forearms. He didn't let go, and Wanda thrashed, trying to free herself, but she's too intoxicated to really fight back. Eventually, she died, and Carol released his grip. He stretched his hands and began to disrobe her. She defecated on herself, and now he couldn't stand to bring himself to have sex with her body. Her death was a complete waste for him. Frustrated, he tossed her clothing by a nearby tree and dragged her body further down the alleyway. Her skin was cut from the combination of gravel and shattered glass. When a call was placed reporting a lifeless body in an alleyway, police immediately respond. It's clear that she died of strangulation, and a search of the area brought police to recover her discarded pants. Inside her pocket was her driver's license. Bar owners were asked if she was a customer, and one owner recalled that she was in there the night before with a bar regular known only as Eddie. There were no other leads in her case. Carol seemed to lie low for a while, returning to the halfway house that he had been missing from for over 3 days. He requested a second chance and got it. He still went out drinking and was able to quell his urges until November 30th, 1980. He was at a bar near the halfway house called Club DeVille where he met 43-year-old Sally Thompson. He and Sally had several drinks together before she invited him back to her apartment a few blocks away. She told him how lonely she had been and wanted a man to live with her. They arrived at her apartment and continued kissing and heavy petting. They sat on the couch and suddenly, Sally had a change of heart and rescinded her offer. Carol could no longer live with her. What was she thinking? The indecisiveness frustrated Carol to no end and he got up and began choking her. After she died, her jeans and underwear were pulled down to her ankles. Then he heard the doorknob jiggling. He waited a moment to see if it would stop, but it wouldn't. He got up and opened the door to find two young men, Sally's sons and their girlfriends, at the door. The boys looked past Carol and saw their mother on the floor. They rushed towards her and saw that she was dead. Frightened by the scene, the boys ran to a neighbor's door and asked them to call the police. Carol remained at the scene. When police arrived, they questioned him about what was going on. He said that they had come home together, but when they were getting ready to disrobe and have sex, Sally suddenly fell to the floor and stopped breathing. He attempted CPR, and that is when the boys arrived. He was arrested and brought in for further questioning. He gave his full name, Carol Edward Cole, and was placed in lockup until the medical examiner could confirm Carol's version of events. When the cause came back as undetermined and having found no violent trauma to her body, Carol was released back to the halfway house. When Detective Gerald Robinson arrived to the station the next day, he reviewed the Thompson case file. He noticed a familiar name. Edward. Shortened, it was Eddie. He looked up the address of the halfway home and found that it was a few blocks from the bar and alleyway where Wanda's body was discovered. Detective Robinson and other officers went to the Toys R Us warehouse where Carol was employed and picked him up for further questioning. He retold the version of events surrounding Sally's death. When questioned about Wanda, he reluctantly confirmed that he was an acquaintance of hers. Detective Robinson wasn't making any headway with Carol. Just as he was about to end the questioning, he was interrupted by a call to go to a scene of an officer-involved shooting. He noticed that Carol seemed bothered or offended by the interruption. He started to close the case file and get up when Carol began describing a murder he committed. Detective Robinson stood there in disbelief. Was this really happening? It took him some time to realize that Carol was not describing the deaths of Sally or Wanda. No, he was describing the death of a third victim. He excused himself and searched records for recent deaths. He found a report on the death of Dorothy King. He returned to the interrogation room and asked if this was the woman he was speaking about. Carol confirmed and officially had an audience for his confessions to the murder of Dorothy King, Wanda Faye Roberts, and Sally Thompson. The rest of that evening, he confessed and described some of the murders he committed in California, Nevada, and Wyoming. He was booked at Dallas County Jail on 3 counts of first-degree murder. Prosecutors faced an uphill battle since the medical examiner had already listed the cause of death as accidental, caused by their continued and heavy use of alcohol. San Diego authorities claimed that there was no way Carol killed anyone in their city, as he left no bruise marks on their necks. There was no way he was that good. He was observed by psychiatrists, and they were taken aback by his lackadaisical recounting of the murders. However, they deemed him as mentally fit to stand trial. On April 6, 1981, his trial began. He took the stand in his own defense and finally shared his childhood. In a surprising turn of events, he also mentioned 3 additional murders while on the stand. 2 in San Diego, and the unnamed woman he supposedly ate in Oklahoma. It seemed as if he was exaggerating some aspects of the crime in order to convince the jurors that he was criminally insane. The jurors deliberated for 25 minutes and found him guilty on all 3 counts. The judge sentenced him to life without the possibility of parole on April 9, 1961. Authorities in Dallas had shared information with other law enforcement agencies across the country, asking them to search their databases for any homicides that matched Carol's M.O. Las Vegas detectives took heed and flew down to Dallas to question Carol on the deaths of Kathleen Blum and Marie Cushman. Carol, without much hesitation, confirmed and confessed to their murders. Finally, detectives had what they needed to request the extradition of Carol Cole to Nevada. Authorities in San Diego were still not convinced, since the women he confessed to murdering all likely died from alcohol-related illnesses or overdose. They said if he did commit the murders, that it wouldn't have taken much to kill them, as they were likely on their last legs. In November of 1982, he began plotting his escape from Huntsville Penitentiary in Huntsville, Texas. He concocted his plan to the T, but was injured while working in the wood shop and transferred to another facility. In January of 1984, he received word that his mother, Vesta Cole, had passed away. He didn't know how to unpack his thoughts and feelings about her death, so he refused to acknowledge it. In February of that same year, Las Vegas PD announced their plans to extradite him to face trial. Carol made the decision that he would do all he could to ensure he received the death penalty. On August 16, 1984, he pled guilty to 2 counts of first-degree murder. His attorney fought to have Carol's right to request his punishment revoked, but Carol simply told the court that there was nothing good about him, and that if released, he would kill again. The court heeded his warning and sentenced him to death by lethal injection. He was transferred to Nevada State Prison in Carson, Nevada. He blocked any attempts to appeal his death sentence, He was adamant. He wanted to die. His execution date was set for December 6, 1985. He penned an autobiography and granted a physician the rights to study his brain after he died. He was never charged in California, Oklahoma, or Wyoming for the murders he committed. He granted an interview prior to his death.
What about the stress, Ed? Is it changing? Is it getting harder? Is it getting easier? What's it like?
Well, it's been getting harder.
Has it?
Yeah, since Friday night, actually. But the last couple of days have been real emotionally, not mentally drained, not emotionally drained. Just feel tired and everything like that, exhausting.
Time going by quicker, slower?
Fast.
Fast.
Mm-hmm.
Has that made you change your mind in any way?
No.
Has it once ever occurred to you to delay
always,
this?
Well, it's always occurred, but...
Why not fight for your life?
I just don't care to.
Are you sorry?
For the victim?
Yes.
Yes.
Are you?
Mm.
Anyone in particular?
Especially the one that was the 11-year-old girl way back in 1967. And even doing that 5-year sentence, it wasn't... That wasn't enough, but it affected me, just also because I not suffered, but I thought about it and condemned myself for many years, because I can just imagine what her life might have been like.
What was the little girl's name again?
Riverton.
What about the religious aspect of it, Ed?
Well, like I told you before, that's kind of personal.
But it's there.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about this execution, are you afraid that there might be some pain involved? After all, we don't really know. This is the first time that the state has carried out this type of execution.
If I said if I wasn't concerned about that, I'd be lying. Because everybody wants to go the easiest, most comfortable way.
Does that enter your mind, though, that you might...
It has entered my mind, yeah. They might, something might go wrong, or be some kind of suffering, but that has not altered my decision.
Do you deserve to die?
I can't answer that question.
Well, it's the ultimate question. It is the question.
For what I did, yes, I think I deserve to die.
On December 6, 1985, at 5:30 p.m., he was given his last meal, tossed salad with French dressing, jumbo shrimp, French fries, and Boston clam chowder. He also finished off what remained of the 25 pounds of cookies and candy sent to him by Mike and Judy Newton, who assisted him in writing his autobiography. A recent convert to Roman Catholicism, he played cards with the priest until it was time to go. He entered the execution chamber, calm, and was strapped to the gurney. He looked over to Mike and Judy and mouthed to them that it was all right. He waited for the drugs to be administered and was pronounced dead at 2 o'clock a.m. He was 47 years old. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review in Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app of choice. It really does help us out and brings more people to the show. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast, Instagram TCFC_podcast, and of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. Case suggestions can be sent to us at tcfcpod@gmail.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor for the show, please check out our website, truecrimefanclub.com/sponsors. The official composer for the show is We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Check him out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or wetalkofdreams.com. Research assistance and content editing for the show is provided by Brittany Martinez. Audio engineering is provided by the talented Chez Gray Music. Please join the True Crime Fan Club discussion group on Facebook. You'll have to answer one question, and then our lovely mods will add you.